Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a political reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. I'm very thankful to be back this week. Special thanks to everyone for filling in while I was out sick.
We hope you feel better, Chris.
Yeah, well, your voice is now golden again.
And joining me in our old studio is...
Jason Rosenbaum of the St. Louis Beacon.
And...
Joe Mianis of the St. Louis Beacon.
Guys?
Well, yeah, we're old school.
We're doing a classic version. No guests this week.
Yeah, the classic.
We will be returning to the newfangled version next week when we have a guest.
Yes. No guests this week. It's Thanksgiving week. We didn't want to make someone come in to our studio when they should be at home with their families. Like we should be.
Yeah, but we're just losers, so here we are.
I don't want that. I've got a whole family coming, so.
And I'm going to Florida, so I'm a winner.
Florida sounds a lot better than my old Kentucky home, but.
Well, let's get into it.
Okay, yeah, yes. Let's get into it. Joe, okay. You had a story go up this week. Tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, yeah, actually, I can fit it into why we're here, because actually, if things had worked out, most of us wouldn't be here. At least myself, I'd be in Jeff City today monitoring this meeting
right.
of healthcare, which got killed last week in the fight between the Governor Jay Nixon and the leaders of the House and Senate committees that were looking on how to transform Medicaid. And because of a spat over
location,
and also how it was supposed to be conducted, the governor basically didn't set up this meeting and wanted to talk to them. And they're like, well, if we're going to have this meeting, we're going to be in charge and you'll be called as a witness. And
things under oath.
And well, no, they dropped that part.
They dropped that part.
But the point is, it went downhill from there. So my point was of my story, and I'm not the only person who's thought about this. I don't claim to be that, is that this type of spat is the type of thing that is often happens, or maybe not to this degree, right before a session starts. But also what's happening, this actually puts the focus back on the other thing that's happening before session starts, in that Speaker Tim Jones has set up. He set up one special committee and charged another existing committee with probing the recent departures of two of Nixon's department heads amid accusations that they were being discriminatory, especially to older women who had been working for the state for a long time.
That was the accusations within the Labor Department.
Correct. Right. The
accusations within the Department of Agriculture are a little bit different, but they involve a hostile work environment.
No, but some of those women who were being targeted by Hagler also had been there for a while.
Right, but continue.
So, in fact, some people had been pointing that out to me, that they see a similarity, and Jones does. Jones claims he's going to try to show a link there. So this is in part maybe a Republican appeal for the women's vote. Who knows? But seriously, my point being is that you're going to have these committees that are going to be talking about this. And the point of my story was that all of a sudden, instead of being focused on some of the issues that the governor wants to talk about, Medicaid and other things looking forward, you've got at least two House committees that are going to be doing investigations. A la some of the stuff you've seen in the U.S. House with Daryl Issa on what's happening or what has happened within his administration. And one of Jones's contentions is that Nixon has, quote, blown through a number of department heads, that the state's not being run well. That's Jones's narrative that he's trying to press. Well, the point is that here, if you're going to have these investigations right before or right as the legislature goes back into session, it sort of takes the attention away from whatever issues there are, i.e. Medicaid expansion, exchanges, other things, that the governor would rather focus on. And as UMSL professor Dave Robertson points out in my story, he contends, and he actually may have a good point, he thinks that part of this is really about trying to control the agenda, trying to set the stage for the legislative session, who will be in a stronger position. And so that the Republicans, even though Nixon can't run for re-election as governor, they want to knock him down a peg, particularly going into the 2014 elections, because the Democrats are hoping to make at least a little headway in the huge Republican majorities that the House and Senate has.
Right.
And the Republicans want to set the stage to see if they can make 2014 like 2010, when they had huge gains on the state level And, of course, this fits in with the national narrative, too.
Well, Joe, I mean, isn't part of the legislative role to monitor some of these executive departments? If there's serious allegations of mismanagement, I know that there's an aura of politics involved here. Wouldn't it be malpractice for the legislators not to look into this more?
Well, I think you're right. And I think this is one of those cases where, well, in government, there's a lot of this, where you've got the governmental role and the legit, you know, stuff on both sides, just like the whole thing about Medicaid expansion. There's a legitimate questions there. But then it also gets enmeshed in the politics of it because people running government have to be elected to do so. And in order to do so, they also have to put themselves in a better light in this and that. The problem is, in some cases, and I'm not saying it's going to happen in this case, but there's always a danger on either side of the politics beginning to trump the substance. So they always have to be careful to make sure that they keep it focused. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. You can look at what happened in Washington during the shutdown in October where they had policy objectives, regardless of what side you're on. But then by the end of it, you know, it was all political and the policy objectives kind of got swallowed up and forgotten. So this is something that I think both sides will be monitoring. And the issue will be, can the governor kind of tamp down this? He hasn't said much on it. I talked to him, and all he said was that he's looking forward, not back. He doesn't want to replay the past. But this is the same guy who, as Attorney General in 2007, was extremely critical. In fact, he said he was, quote, disgusted by the behavior of the Agriculture Department director at the time, Fred Farrell, who was accused of similar stuff. This was when Matt Blunt was governor.
Yeah, and I was going to jump in on that because I actually have the quotes up now. And for veterans of the Missouri Capitol, this does have kind of an aura of familiarity because in 2007, when Fred Farrell was kind of jettisoned from his position, he was jettisoned not only because of sensational sexual harassment allegations, but because he was accused of not promoting women in the Agriculture Department. Well, now you look at the situation with the Labor Department, where Gracia Backer, a former Democratic legislator, is accusing then-director Larry Redman of not promoting women, in fact, trying to replace a whole raft of women.
Yeah, who were in high levels. And she contends that she filed an EEOC complaint. My point of my story was that this whole flap over Hagler and the Department of Agriculture and his treatment of women, so far there have been no charges filed or anything.
But a human rights complaint, essentially.
But in the Gracia Backer case, it's different because she has filed a complaint which has been accepted by the EEOC. And this could very well end up in court, which makes it a whole different ballgame. My point that the Department of Labor situation, actually, there may be more, regardless of whether there's true substance, it has the potential of being a bigger headache for the governor because that case is likely to end up in court. What Backer's contention is, and I have her file, which is pretty thick, is that she had been enlisted by Redmond. She was one of the real higher-ups to help go after these women. And when she declined to do so, then all of a sudden she became a target and that she had gone to members of the Nixon administration. She told me who. I won't get into names, but that she went into top aides of his administration to tell him what was going on. And one source told me she actually made some comment to the governor's spouse at an event. Point is that nothing allegedly was done from her perspective, or when it was done, they were like, Gracia, you got to go. They moved Redmond into a job.
Yeah, but yeah, that's the point.
They moved him into a job.
After the Farrell situation came to light, he was essentially fired.
Right.
Redmond was given essentially a six-figure job as an administrative law judge.
Yeah, which is pretty much administrative law judges are in effect lifetime appointments.
And, you know, I want to just read for the record what Nixon said at the time about it. And, you know, I'm not trying to say the Fred Farrell situation shouldn't have gotten coverage and it wasn't a serious situation because it was a serious situation.
Right.
When somebody is calling people show dogs and asking them to be on wet t-shirt contests and not promoting them, that's a serious slate of allegations.
Correct.
But this is what then Attorney General Nixon said at the time. this is a very serious issue. He said this at Hannibal Days in 2007.
Yes. Yeah,
the fact
there.
That a department director in the state of Missouri let it be known to their employees that women did not have the same advancement opportunities as men in that department is very wrong. He then went on to say, and in my years of public service and my years as attorney general, I've run an office that has provided a broad level of opportunity to a very diverse group of people without any of these particular problems. That was candidate Nixon in 2007. Right. Now, in 2013, when he's governor, he is essentially encountering these same groups of problems, not necessarily because Nixon, you know, wants sexual harassment or discrimination to be going on. I'm not saying that. I don't think he went about trying to get these people in. And these are just allegations, too. They
Correct.
May not end up being true. But the bottom line is Nixon and a lot of other Democrats were a lot more critical of this situation when they were, you know, out of power. And now you have a situation that has some very serious allegations behind it. I don't think you're hearing a lot of Democratic outcry this time, possibly because, you know, a lot of things have changed.
Well, they don't want to cross the governor, and this doesn't matter. This doesn't affect this. This takes place whoever is governor. During the whole Farrell thing, it wasn't like the Republicans were up front as they normally would. They are more up front now because they're bringing this stuff up. And in fact, Speaker Jones, when I talked to him, made this comment that Nixon, he contended that Nixon was sort of lives in a glass house now when he's. Because he said that stuff in the past, and now in this situation, he's trying to ignore it. Now, some say that, well, the governor may not have been fully apprised of what was going on. This was his aides trying to hide some of this.
That very well might be the
case.
But
in any event, you know, the buck stops here, whether you're the governor or the president. But the point of my story was that, this has the potential of becoming a major headache, just like the last session where they ended up being all about those concealed carry permits,
right.
which is where whether the issue was legit or not or how serious it was, which I'm not going to debate, but the point is it overwhelmed everything else. So there are a lot of other major issues that the governor and other people wanted to have dealt with last session didn't happen because all there was going on half the time were these hearings over these concealed carry permits and, you know, needing certain stuff for driver's licenses. So my point in the story was that this has the potential of becoming that and possibly more if the backer thing ends up in court.
So let's transition to something Chris has been working on because
speaking of Nixon and the courts.
Because we've been blabbing on for now like 300 minutes about this. But you've done some exceptional work on executions and policy. Just kind of tell us a little bit about, you know, the crux of your stories and what you've discovered in the past weeks and months.
So this is another topic that also encompasses Nixon and the courts. In order to tell this story, you kind of have to start a month ago when Missouri had a different way of carrying out executions. We were going to use a drug called propofol, which is a really common anesthetic. Hospitals use it all across the United States. Most of it is manufactured in the European Union, about 90% of it.
Okay.
And the European Union is, of course, very anti-death penalty, very anti-capital punishment. If Missouri had gone through with it, it's very likely that there would have been sanctions and hospitals would have been affected and it would have been harder for them to get this important drug. That's one of the issues. The other issue is that none of the manufacturers of this drug want it to be used for executions, and that includes U.S. manufacturers and overseas manufacturers. So it was a big question of where did Missouri get a hold of this drug when none of the manufacturers want it. We were actually the first outlet that reported that Missouri obtained it from someone who wasn't authorized to sell it by the drug manufacturer. They bought it from someone in the Northwest United States. And through some documents, we found that both the Department of Corrections and this drug distributor both knew that they were violating the manufacturer's wishes when they bought it. We reported that story on a Wednesday, and then on the Friday, Nixon announced that there was going to be a change, the executions were going to be postponed, there was going to be a new drug. About a week later, the Department of Corrections came back with a new protocol, a new way to carry out executions, a drug called pentobarbital, which is what a lot of veterinarians use to euthanize animals.
Right.
So they made that change, and then they decided that they were going to have that drug come from a compounding pharmacy, because this is another drug where
Correct.
No drug manufacturers.
What's a compounding pharmacy?
A compounding pharmacy is a pharmacy that can mix up some drugs to make them. The difference between compounding pharmacies and drug manufacturers is compounding pharmacies, they're supposed to be used for very, very specific circumstances. Let's say I have a son. He's in the hospital. He's 6 years old. He really needs a drug. He can't swallow pills because he's a six-year-old kid. Compounding pharmacy can take the drug that he needs, put it into,
a liquid form.
Right.
So they receive a specific prescription for a specific patient, and then they carry that out. The thing about compounding pharmacies is that they aren't regulated by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, like drug manufacturers are.
Correct.
The other thing about compounding pharmacies is that they're regulated by state boards of pharmacy. The Missouri Board of Pharmacy in their inspections have found that about one out of every five drugs made by compounding pharmacies aren't as potent as they should be. They're unsatisfactory. And so that would be a real issue if Missouri tried to carry out an execution and this drug wasn't potent enough.
Yes.
The other change that they made, while the Department of Corrections was changing their execution protocol, they actually made it illegal to name where the Department of Corrections was obtaining its execution drug. So if we were to tell the story of how Missouri obtained its previous supply, we would be opening ourselves up for a lawsuit.
Well, is that based off a statutory change that's recently been done, or was that just done by fiat?
So that's a very good question. So what happened was, I don't know if you two remember because you two were around. In 2007, there was a statute that was written saying you
yes.
can't name members of the execution.
Yes, I remember
yes.
that.
Yes, yes, yes.
Within that statute, it says refer to the Department of Corrections for the definition of the execution team. In early October, the definition of execution team
was changed.
It was only the people who are literally carrying out the execution, injecting the drug. That sort of thing. Now they changed the definition of the execution team to mean anyone who is involved with supplying, preparing, or otherwise getting the Department of Corrections the drug. So they didn't change any statute, but they did change the definition of the execution team to make it illegal.
Because
two words, court case. I mean, this will probably have to be something that will be decided in court.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of court cases over this. The ACLU has already sued under First Amendment grounds. There are numerous other court cases that are before Missouri courts and federal courts in terms of whether or not this is constitutional under Eighth Amendment reasons, cruel and unusual punishment, because compounding pharmacies, there's a big question of, you know, of the potency of their drug. So, yeah, it's going to be a huge court case. I've asked the governor previously what role he played in this execution protocol being changed with the new secrecy, because he made it very public that he was asking for a new drug. But he didn't say within the press release or anything that he was asking for the supplier to be secret. I can actually play that clip now of him speaking to me.
Terrific.
So you didn't instruct them to change the definition of the execution team like they did?
I didn't. The only thing that I instructed them was that we need to make sure that we have a protocol and for them to move forward vis-a-vis the drug and work effectively to get another method. That's all I said.
You know, it's interesting that all of these issues usually come up when there's an execution, and I know that following the legislature, there is actually a bipartisan group of legislators who are against the death penalty and who routinely file legislation to put a moratorium on there, put a study, possibly even end it. From your reporting, do you think that these issues might tip legislators to consider something like that, or are these kind of not really reaching the scale to where it might become a public issue?
Well, there were some lawmakers who were against the secrecy over the people actually carrying out the executions, the execution team as it was previously defined. Now that it's been expanded, I would imagine that those lawmakers would continue to be against this. But I don't know if it's going to get to the point where there's a large outcry over the secrecy. I think that there would have to be something very dramatic. We would have to be able to find out that the reason that they've been hiding it is because the compounding pharmacy, you know, isn't one that they would be proud of getting their drug from. I don't know. I mean, Missouri is a state where the death penalty is not an unpopular thing.
Well, it's in most states. It's not. In fact, candidates on both sides often try. Here's where politics meshes with policy again, where they try to. They don't want to appear weak. That's
can't be soft on crime,
right? So the whole thing about not being so, which is why. Well, I don't want to say this is why Attorney General Chris Coster has gotten involved, because there's legitimate policy reasons. Because he was involved last week in ending the stay that had delayed the most recent execution of just a few days ago. But that said, there's a political component in that Coster is running for governor in 2016. And it does put himself, while he may have policy reasons for doing what he did, there is a political fallout from it. So, again, when you look down the road here, I can see where there, this whole issue of what kind of drugs are used, this will have even the people who are concerned about what's happening, if they're running for office, they want to appear to be focusing on certain parts of it. They don't want to appear weak or not or soft on crime.
Well, it'll also be when Coster essentially vacates that office for the people that are running for it on both sides, that might become an issue.
And, well, yeah, no.
And State Senator Kurt Schaefer, who's planning on running for Attorney General, he's echoed Chris Coster's comments that maybe we should bring back the gas chamber.
Right.
And
this
is Speaker Tim Jones, who's looking at Attorney General.
And the thing is that this is a problem that a lot of states are having where you aren't having states or courts decide that executions are unconstitutional or something that we shouldn't be doing. You're having these private companies who are saying, we don't want our drugs to be used that way. So they're having to turn to a lot of alternatives in order to carry out these
executions. What about the electric chair? Might they bring that back?
So in Missouri statute, there are only two ways that they can carry out executions. One would be gas chamber, and the other would be lethal injection. The thing about the gas chamber is Missouri doesn't have a gas chamber.
Right.
I think one of you two were there with me when Nixon was asked about the gas chamber, and he just completely brushed it off. He's like, we don't have a gas chamber.
I believe that was a quintessential Kevin Colleen question.
Yes, it was.
So. But seriously, might they change the law to either bring back the electric chair, or in some states they still allow firing squads?
Firing squad in Utah, if I'm not
mistaken. Yes. Right. That was only a couple years ago. I would be surprised if that were to happen. I think that would take executions to a whole different grisly level.
Yeah, but there are some states that do it. I remember when I'm old enough, this is before your time, when there was a period where the death penalty was not used. That's why Charles Manson's still alive, because he was supposed to have been executed back before you were born. Mm-hmm. But there was a period of years after the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional the way that it was being provided then. When it was reinstated, one of the Utah executions by firing squad was one of the first ones that was used, and that was declared constitutional. That's my point.
One thing, I'm not positive on this, but I'm pretty sure that in Utah the case was the inmate chose the firing squad and had other options.
Correct.
I would be very surprised if it was, we are choosing the firing squad for you because we can't come up with a different drug to kill you. I would be very surprised if that happened.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there'd have to be a statutory change.
Yes.
But great.
And that would involve a lot more publicity than I think that they
would
on
agree.
This issue.
But it's just great work on that, you and
Veronique
DiCaprio.
Yeah, you guys have done really good work on that.
Well, thanks, guys.
But let's talk about a lighter topic.
Taxes.
Taxes.
Transportation. Yes.
So I think we've talked on this show about this 1 cent sales tax for transportation in this legislative context, because it was an issue in this past legislative session. As everybody who listened to our conversation with Senator John Lamping remembers, he was involved in filibustering a ballot initiative essentially to death with two other conservative state senators, as well as Paul Lavoda of Independence, a Democrat who kind of got involved as well. Well, as predicted, it's come back as an initiative petition, a constitutional amendment, and it's going to have a lot of diverse bipartisan support behind it. Labor unions, business groups, agriculture groups, and politicians of all stripes have come out for it. But not only do you have those conservative elements that I mentioned, but you also have some liberal, progressive, left of center groups who are against it because they fear that a sales tax increase would hurt the poor and the elderly the most because it would eat away at fixed incomes.
Right.
And that has kind of come to pass yesterday when the Missouri Association for Social Welfare filed a lawsuit against a ballot summary of this. Among other things, they've noted that on the ballot summary that was crafted by Secretary of State Jason Kander, and you can kind of read it on their site or on our site, it seems to say that it's a 1% increase for the sales tax, which is true. It goes from 4.225 to 5.225. Well, they pointed out that while that is a 1% increase, if you do the math, it's actually like a 23% increase from one to the other. And that should be put in the summary as well as a bunch of other things. So the reason why this is important is this is usually the method that antagonists use to attack ballot summaries. They go to court, they say that the ballot summary is unfair, and they try to get groups mired in this litigation. Not only does it cost groups money, but if for some reason a judge changes that summary, it means that all the signatures they got essentially are voided and they have to start over because they've been using a different summary to collect their signatures. So we'll see what happens there. But I think it just showcases once again that this sales tax idea, well, again, it has bipartisan support. You have everybody from Steve Tilley, who was on, to Claire McCaskill, and all sorts of people in between supporting. It has bipartisan opposition to it. So
where would that money be going, Jason, if this were to become?
It would go into this fund, essentially. The majority of it would go into this fund that would then fund a list of transportation projects that are kind of come up with by MoDOT. 90% of that would be the case. And, I mean, It could be I-70. It could be all sorts of highways. I mean, that will have to be done if that passes. But it also goes to cities and counties, about 10% of it as well. And I think that the proponents of this say that the infrastructure and transportation needs of the state are so great that it requires something like this, especially since, you know, gas taxes and tollways are not as popular. But, you know, and opponents of this have all sorts of reasons of being against because it's a pretty sizable tax increase. So were you writing something down there?
Yes. I was recommending that one of the things that we need to mention, though, kind of segueing from this, forgetting this other topic, drop that.
Okay.
But this kind of meshes with the fact that there's some Republicans, including Tilley, who are now raising money for Dooley. And you wonder if some of that may be connected to either some of these initiatives, including like the merger or other things, and whether or not some of this stuff could play a key role in the county executive's race over the next few months, especially if the Republicans fail to come up with somebody, a major name.
Possibly. I don't know if these two issues are going to intersect, but I do know that there are a lot of major highways that go through St. Louis County, for example, 64 and 44 and I-170, and transportation will definitely be an issue. But I would imagine that this is going to be more of a statewide fight, depending on if they get the signatures. So
yeah,
should be fun.
Yeah, because one of the things that we – because so far the Beacon's only one that's been – they got confirmation there was a bunch of Republicans who did, including Tilley, who did a fundraiser last week for St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley, and he's a Democrat. And that does put the perspective of business being behind Dooley while labor is behind his Democratic challenger, fellow Democratic challenger, Steve Stenger. So
this is the second time this year that Tilley has supported a prominent Democrat.
Yes, that's right.
Attorney General Chris Koster.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I guess you enter into the lobbyist realm, you are more bipartisan with your giving, I suppose. But he mentioned – we talked about this on that podcast. I mean, he kind of can speak for himself on that. And I encourage all of our listeners to listen to that podcast because it's probably one of my favorite ones. And not just because we made fun of him a lot. So.
Yes. Well, and we'll have hopefully everybody has a good time at Thanksgiving. I'm having my family over. I still
are you staying in Missouri, Joe?
Yes. I'm the mom in this case.
Yeah. I am not. As I said, I'm going to Florida, as I'm already mentioned.
Now, Chris, where are you going?
I'm I'm heading back to Louisville, Kentucky, which is where I'm from. That's where my whole family will be. So we'll have a big family gathering with probably around 20 people.
Wow. I would say.
Well, extended family members, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles and everything. But yeah, should be good. Yeah. I haven't been home for far too long, as I've been routinely reminded by my family.
Well, Thanksgiving, I think, is one of the purest of the American holidays. It really is mainly about family, and it hasn't gotten so political.
Unless you're a Native American.
I love.
Sorry.
And we wanted to end on such a positive note after some really downer topic here. But before we close this out here, you can read all of my stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can read all of Joe and Jason's stories at stlbeacon.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. You can follow Jason on Twitter at
J Rosenbaum.
And Joe?
At J Manis. That's JMANNIES.
Everyone have a safe and happy Thanksgiving. We'll be back next week. Until then, so long.
So long.
Gobble, gobble.